Okay. Chapter, Parakaf Hei, 25. That's, we're going to be here for a while. We're not going anywhere fast.
Let me quote you.
This is one of those prakim that it's just, it's so...
dense.
Well, besides being dense, and there's a lot of material and a lot of stuff to deal with. It's a long parakut, a long story. It's also one of those fundamental pieces, turning points in the Sefer as a whole, and in many ways Tanakh as a whole. So it requires a little more deliberation. So we are, for today, what I wanted to focus on is... the role that David and his people play in this region of the country. We've touched on this a number of times. This gedud or group of people that follow David around. We saw them earlier we gathers them together in Marat Adulam. We've seen them pop up from time to time. We saw them in the story of Shaul and in the cave when David is fighting with his men because his men want to kill Shaul and David's saying no, and then see that again later. And certainly here we are for the first time introduced to their role in a larger context, meaning their role to protect Nabal's shepherds and their flock, and to play a role in the kind of almost in a military sense. We actually saw them militarily once before, if you remember, when they went to defend the city of Kila'ah. Remember when we were attacked by the Plishtim, and David asked, should I go defend them? And God said yes, and so he goes, and he takes his men. So we've seen them already in a role of defense, defending the settlements and the cities, the Israelite cities, from possible attack from Plishtim and from others. Keilah was a previous... I think that was before Zif, if you remember. Perakov Chavgimel, Chavet, Chavgimel, beginning of Chavgimel. Hinei plishtim milchamim bakeila. Vayishal David b'Hashem lemor ha'elech v'iketi b'plishtim ha'ele. The plishtim attacked Keila, which is on the border between Eretz Plishtim and Shevet Yehuda. David asked, should I go? Should I defend them? Should I participate? God said yes. So Vayomer Hashem David Lech Vikitaba Plishtim Vayomu Anshei David Ela Vine Anachnu Po B'Yuda Yireim Afkin Elech Kila. Right? The people are afraid. They're hiding in Yehuda. Why should they go to Kila? But nonetheless, David goes, and Pasuk Hey Vayelech David Vanashav Kila Vayilachem Baplishtim. David and his men went, smote the people of the Plishtim, and were able to secure a great victory for the people of Keilah, which unfortunately for David didn't go so well, because then he was afraid that they would inform on him to Shaul, which is exactly what he was afraid of, and so he runs. But there also we saw the emergence of this band or this group of people that David has gathered around him as a kind of military group. And David is their warrior. David is their leader. And you really feel that sense. That's the role that David is playing in this period of time. And he has this group of followers who are really an army. Ragtag army, army of mercenaries, an army of people, Mari Nefesh. We saw the common denominator between all of them are that they have sort of bitter people, people who have lost their lands, lost their families, lost their debts, their financial resources, have nothing more to lose, kind of thing. They've hit rock bottom. The description of them is Mari Nefesh, bitter, is Bnei Bliya'al, which is a term that is not a term of endearment, but we've seen that term many times. They are also described as Bnei Belial. But nonetheless, what they share in common is this kind of crisis that they've hit, and David gathers them together as a kind of a father figure and a leader for them. and they become his army. And at the end of Shmuel Bet, you have a much deeper description. The very end of Perek Bet, Shmuel Bet, you have a series of prakim that are really out of place. They're out of place chronologically, because that really from Parakhov Bet till the end of Shmuel, in Shmuel Bet, the end, Parakhov Bet till the end, are really a, actually even to an extent Parakhov Aleph, is really a fallback on earlier events. Why it's there at the end of Shmuel Bet is unclear. Maybe one day we'll get to the end of Shmuel Bet, we'll talk about it. But Shirat David is certainly earlier. Okay, Vayedaber David LaHashem et divrei haShirah hazot b'yom hitzil HaShem oto mikaf kol oyviv u'mikaf Shaul. This is a Shirah that he sang when he was victorious against Shaul. Victorious against Shaul is the end of Shmuel Aleph, the beginning of Shmuel Bet. This is the last chapters of Shmuel Bet. So clearly that's out of place. And then Parachav Gimel, Eile Divrei David HaAchronim, Nu'um David Ben Yishai, Nu'um Agebu Kamal. This is a description of his kind of, again, his Shira, to thanksgiving to God for the various victories. And if you look at Perek, again, Shmuel Bet, Perek Chav Gimel, Pasuk Chet. Eile Shmot HaGiborim Asher LeDavid. Yoshev Bashevet Tachkamoni Rosh HaShlishi Hu Adino HaEtzni Al Shmona Meot Chalal B'Pam Achat. This is the names of David's Giborim, the name of David's warriors. Shmuel Bet, Perek Chav Gimel. Yeah, the end of Shmuel Bet. The end of Shmuel Bet is a series of prakim that are just totally out of place. And where they belong is an interesting piece. I think they belong exactly where we are right now. And why do I say that? I'll show you, but the list, this parak is basically a list of the names of David's warriors, the generals in his army. First amongst them, right, the Shemot HaGiborim, Rosh HaShlishi, Edno HaEtzni, Acharav Elazar Ben Dodo, Ben Achoti, Bishlosha Giborim Im David. They operate in units of three. Anybody see where I am?
Yeah,
they're up. Perek Shmuel Bet, Perek Chav Gimel, Pasuk Tet.
It's 787.
Seven, I have no
idea. And this
one is 397. Right. You know, I'm not going to read through the whole perek, and you don't have to necessarily see all the details. It's a perek which lists David's warriors, and we're not going to go through all the names and all of the details, but it literally lists them, and they operate in units of three. Bishlosha hagiborim David, v'chofam beplishtim, they're fighting against the plishtim. David becomes king of Israel. He's not fighting against the plishtim anymore. He's fighting against Ammon and Moab and Aram Tzova and major empires. He's not fighting against the plishtim. The plishtim are done. But if you're talking about a time in which David's warriors are fighting against the plishtim, that's not the end of Shmuel Bet. That's the end of Shmuel Aleph. So clearly this parak is out of place.
These guys don't sound Jewish.
They are, it's just they have different names.
The Herodite, Peles, the Palatite.
Yeah, some of them are, some of them aren't.
Ira sounds Jewish.
Avishai, Achi Yoav ben Tzruya. Avishai and Yoav ben Eitz Tzruya. Tzruya is David's sister, by the way. His two major generals, Avishai and Yoav, are his nephews. We often miss that because Tzruyah is his sister, is an apostle in Divayamim we read last week.
Yeah.
But Yoav ben Tzruyah and Avishai ben Tzruyah, Tzruyah is David's sister. It's an interesting observation. I think it's the only place in Tanakh that identifies a name by somebody's mother. Avishai ben Tzruyah and Yoav ben Tzruyah, Tzruyah is their mother, not their father. Interesting question. But okay. But it literally goes through the whole parak, and you'll see it's just the names of one gibor after another, all of whom who fought with David. Now, why do I think this is in our period of history? Is because if you look at the next parak, parak Chav Dalid, pasuk Yud Aleph. There's more to, but I'll just one reference to Dvar Hashem Haya El Gad HaNavi Chose David Lemor. The Navi accompanying David at this period of time is
God.
God is the Navi who told him to come out of hiding way back a couple of prakim ago. By the time David is in Yerushalayim, sitting in the palace and dealing with the question of building a Beit HaMikdash, which is the beginning of Shmuel Bet, the Navi accompanying him is Natan. God is there when he's running and is on the run and he's a fugitive. So the reference here to God is another indicator that this is a much earlier parak. Why is any of that important? Because it's a reflection of the context in which David is operating here. We're looking at stories, but we need to pull back and look at the context. What's this whole period of time about? This whole period of history, this whole period of time in David's life, is about this group of men who are within these giborim. Now, what we see is a band of 400 Mare Nafesh. By the end of Shmuel Bet, they're described in great acts of heroics and warrior structure. This is an army. This is the beginning of David's army, and it's a very powerful army. And not to be discounted. They're a force to contend with, and they can either be an ally or they can be a threat. And we'll see both of those sides in a moment. And so that's the world of David's operation. They're described as Arba Meot, right? But we know there's more than 400. How do we know there's more than 400? It starts back in chapter 22 as 400 men. But
they pick up some people along the way.
Clearly they have to, because by the time they go to war with Ziklag, and even here, right, there's 600. There's 400 to go to war and 200 to stay to watch the watch the rest of the camp. So they are clearly growing, and then there's the families. They settle the city of Ziklag. There's a major operation. But so this band of 400, which is what it was in Parakhov Bet, beginning of Parakhov Bet. David went and he was hiding in Marat Adulam. I'm back in Shmuel Aleph Chaf Bet. Gathered around him all of these distressed people. I'm jumping around today. We're jumping around. Shmuel Aleph Chaf Bet. Vayitkabtzu elav kol ish matzok. He gathered all of these distressed people. Kol ish asher lo noshe. Talked about the debtor, right? The collector, mm-hmm. who comes, the creditor who comes to collect the debts. And in that world, you came to collect debts. That debt collection included your land, your produce, your property, in your family and your children and your slave, and sell you into slavery, right? Creditors were a source of great hardship. V'chol ish mar nafesh, v'hi alehem l'sar, and he became their sar, their general. V'yu imo ke'arba meot ish. How many?
400.
Approximately, right? What does it say? Ke'arba meot ish. How 400? I don't think that number is an accident, and I'm going to come back to the significance of that number in a minute. But he has approximately 400 men. We see later on he has 600. I round off 600 more or less, you get to 400. Interesting question. Why 400?
Well, I just want to raise a thing about the Mare Nefesh.
Yes.
You know how they say, don't read it this way, read it this way? So I say, don't read it Mare Nefesh, read it Mare Nefesh.
Robin and his merry men. So actually, I was recently actually reading an article, and it refers to, it actually, it's interesting. I was reading an article about David and his and his group, and it refers to them analogous to, and it was in Hebrew, so you had to put the Hebrew words into English letters, Robin Hood HaMitologi. Right? So, yeah, you're not so far off. You are not so far off. In our context, and we've seen this type of behavior before. We've seen this kind of distressed people gathering together in a kind of a group that forms an army for hire, mercenaries or other thing. We saw it by Yiftach. Also a similar kind of group, although there the group is not numbered by size. Don't have to turn the page, I'm just going to read the phrase. But there it says, Vayivrach Yiftach, Mipnei Achav. Yiftach was expelled from his brothers. You remember who Yiftach was? Shofet, who was born Shiloh about his Yichus. The mother was a different tribe, or his mother was from a different woman, or some other sordid affair, and the brothers didn't like that he was a threat to their inheritance, so they
threw him out. No one helped him.
Lot tinchal bevet avinu. You will not inherit in our father's house. Ki ben isha acheret ata, you are the son of a different woman, foreign woman, whatever that means. Vayivrach Yiftach mipnei achav v'yesha be'eretz tov. Yiftach ran from his brothers, ran away to Eretz Tov. Vayitlaktu al Yiftach anashim rekim vayitzuimu. Gathered around him a group of empty people. Empty people, and they went with him. They were his vayitzuimu, they went out with him, meaning that's a military term. Right? They became his army. Sefalavo is a military term to go and come back. So the rekim could also be worthless, people with nothing to lose, landless, people who have lost their property, right? Rek in terms of owning anything. Similar to the Marinafish that David surrounds himself with. This is David's group, 400 people, Arba'a Miot Ish. So what did they do to mefarnes themselves? What did they do to earn a parnasa? How did they live? Hiding in the fields and in the caves and the cisterns and in the hideaways of Midbar Yudah, while David and the rest of his people are fugitives from Shaul. What did they do to
the outer protection?
Right. So what we see emerging from our parak is that they were warriors, and they're warriors for hire. Call them mercenaries, mm-hmm. But this was their territory. They knew the land well. They knew the region well. They knew the hills well, and there was need of protection. There was a need of a defense against marauding and raiding enemies. And so they offered themselves to be hired for that purpose. And you see that emerging from this parak clearly. We see it from other stories as well. I showed you part of that before. I'll show you a few more bits and pieces of it. This story is going to emerge in pieces for us. But we have, for example, by us, back to our parak, which is Chaf Hei. Right, in the initial conversation that David has with Naval HaKarmeli through his men, he says in Pasuk Chet, actually Pasuk Zion, Ata shamata ki gozazim lach. Right, we heard that you are. Do everybody have where I am? Back to our parak, Chafei. So if you keep a tab on our parak, which is parak Chafei, Shmuel Aleph Chafei. Ata shamata ki gozazim lach. We heard that you are celebrating the shearing of the flock. Ata ro'im asher lecha yu imanu lo yechlamnu ve'lo nifkad lehem u'uma ko'imei otam b'Karmel. The people, your shepherds, who were with us all the days that they were in Karmel, they were well looked after. They were well looked after. Nothing happened to them. No, we didn't embarrass them. We didn't shame them. It's not clear what that means. Right? We didn't embarrass them or shame them. I mean, what are you paying somebody not to embarrass you? That's sort of a euphemism going on here. And then he says, check with them. Shalnat narecha v'yagidu lecha. Go and ask your own shepherds. Let them confirm. And therefore, my men, my lads, my people who are coming, let them find favor. And we've come at a time when we want you to offer financial support to our shepherds. What exactly he's referring when he says that we didn't embarrass you, we didn't shame you, is less clear than it is in the conversation that ensues a few psukim later between Avigail and the Na'ar. So there, if you go down to Pasuk Yud Dalid, Avigail Eshet Naval Higid Na'ar Echad Me'anarim Lemor. To Avigail, it was told, one of the Na'arim came running and said, Hinei shalach David malachim mi'amidbar levarechat Adonenu vayat bahem. You should know that David sent a delegation from the Midbar to our master to bring blessing, and Naval rejected him. V'anashim tovim lanu ma'od. These people were very good to us. V'lo achlamnu, we weren't shamed, which basically, which is again, yeah, that same word comes up, but it's obviously a euphemism for something much more significant, because then he goes on, v'lopakadnu ma'uma. For all the days that we were there, we lost not a single sheep, not a single member of our, not a single livestock from our flock went missing. Kol yimei hitalachnu itam yotenu basadeh. All the days that we went with them while we were in the field. They were a wall of protection for us all the days that we were there in the field. All the days that we were looking after the flock. So they were our wall. What is a wall?
Protection.
A wall is a wall of protection.
It's like they weren't being harassed.
Correct. We weren't being harassed. Now, who were we not being harassed by? Is ultimately the question. So this is not 1930s Chicago mobsters. This is not mafiosa, right? They are not being harassed because David's people are protecting them. They're not protecting them from themselves in the modern context of the concept. Right? They're protecting them from the raiding and marauding nomads and tribes that are a constant threat in this region of the world.
But they could have also been They could have, chosen it to attack them themselves.
So that would have been, I think that's a modern application of the concept. You don't, it's untenable and unconscionable to make that accusation against David. First of all, remember this entire parak is a positive to David. And second of all, the notion that David is attacking his own people is absurd. Mm-hmm. It's just absurd. I'll show you how absurd it is in a moment. But clearly there are local threats that are a concern to the tribes in the south. We see that evidence clearly. It emerges. I'll show you, for example, where that emerges. We looked at it in part, but let's take a look again back in Perek Lamed. Perek Lamed, there's a piece of the story in the middle between Perek Chafei and Perek Lamed that we're gonna look at today, but I just want to jump to where we were at before, which is Tziklag. What is Tziklag? So Tziklag is a city we just need to know about. What is Tziklag?
Wasn't that where the David went when the Plishtim didn't trust him?
So Tziklag is a city that the Plishtim give David as a location, as a place to live. Tziklag is the first city that David is able to live in openly with his army, with his families, with their men and women and children. That is in Pasuk Perach of Zion. If you look back in Perach of Zion, 27.5. Chav Zion Hay. Vayomer David El Achish. So it's always easy to work with the Tanakh. So these things are way too many. Vayomer David El Achish. You have ever see it? Vayomer David El Achish. This is after when David leaves, after the next time that he is encountered with Shaul, he runs to Achish. Second time he comes to Achish, king of Plishtim. Okay, so he's 27.5. Right, when he's run to the to hide amongst the Plishtim. A period of time that will pose many challenges to him. Vayomer David al Achish, Im na matzati chen be'enecha yitnu li makom ba'achat arei ha'sadeh ve'eshva sham. V'lam yeshev avdecha be'ir ha'mamlecha imach. So David makes a special request of Achish. He says, I'm not going to stay here in the king's city. I need a place to live. And for the first time after Achish accepts him, he asks for a place of his own. And Vayiten lo Achish b'yom ahu et Tziklag. Lachen hayta Tziklag l'malchei Yehuda d'yom hazeh. Took a Plishti city, gave it to David, and he said, okay, this city is yours. And that shifted the allegiance, that shifted the identification of Tziklag from a Plishti city to an Israelite city for the remainder of Tanakh history. So Tziklag becomes part of Shevet Yehuda by virtue of the fact that David and his men settle it. V'hi mispar ha'yamim ha'sheyeshav David b'sdei Plishtim yamim v'arba'a chodashim. So David lived there in Tziklag for a year and 4 months. One of the few references to a timetable in this whole story. But he's hiding in Sefer in the book of Shmuel. He's hiding in the city of Tziklag. Okay. You know what? We're here. I was going to do this out of order, but since we're here already, let's finish the story. Vayal David va'anashav vayivshtu el hagishuri v'hagizri v'ha'amaleki. David and his people, what do? They're warriors. So what do warriors do? They fight. So they went and they fought and they raided the various nomadic tribes of the areas of Gishuri, Gizri, and Amaleki. Now, we don't necessarily know who Gishuri and Gizri are, but we certainly know who Amalek is. And any pretense or illusion that Shaul had removed the threat of Amalek back in Perek Tetvav is hereby dispelled. Ki hine yoshvot ha'aretz asher me'olam bo'acha shuda v'ad eretz Mitzrayim. These Amalekites and their cousins, they have been settled, living in that southern region of the land for all of these years, all the way down. They kind of spread out, like nomads, spread out from the Negev all the way down to Mitzrayim. You follow? Asher yoshvot ha'aretz asher me'olam bo'acha shuva v'yaderet Mitzrayim is a description of where Amalek live. Amalek literally spread out from the Negev all the way down south to Mitzrayim. V'ikad David et ha'aretz. David went with his people. They raided and they attacked place after place. They attacked these cities. V'lo yichya ish v'isha, leaving no survivors. V'lakach tzon uvakar v'chamorim ugmalim uvgadim v'yashov v'yavo el achish. And he took all of the spoils of war, and he brought them to Achish, because again, at this period of time, to whom is his open loyalty?
Plishtim.
To the Plishtim. That's part of the dilemma that he's living with. So he has to prove his loyalty to Achish. How do you prove your loyalty to Achish? Right? You're a warrior. So you hire yourself out to the king as a mercenary army. That is exactly what David did. David runs a massive army that is up for hire. And at this point in time, he's offered those services in lieu of or in exchange of a place to live. He's offered those services to Achish, Melech Gat. So Achish says, okay, prove your worth, prove your loyalty. What do you have to do to prove your loyalty? Go fight and bring me the spoils. What did David have to do? Poor David. What did he have to do to prove his loyalty to Shaul? He had to go and fight against the Plishtim. What does he have to do to prove his loyalty to the Plishtim? Fight against others. Now, again, wait, careful. Let's do that again. To prove his loyalty to Shaul, he has to go and he has to fight against the Plishtim. To prove his loyalty to the Plishtim, what does he have to do? What should he have to do?
Fight the Jews.
For go and fight against the Israelites.
But he doesn't.
Correct? You follow what's going on? So what happens? Vayomer Achish, al pshatetem ayom, tell me, David, where did you raid today? Where did you go? Beautiful spoils, beautiful, successful raid today. Where was it that you went to raid today? Vayomer David, so David said, al negev Yehuda, v'al negev Yerachmeli, v'al negev Akeni. Oh, I raided the Judean hills, and I raided the Israelites, and I raided the Yerachmelites, and I raided this tribe. And right? In other words, what does he tell Achish? That his raiding roots were into the area of Shevet Yehuda. Whereas, where he really went was south into the Eretz in the land of Amalek. Why doesn't he tell it to Achish Melech Gat?
Maybe they were allies.
Yeah, could be. He doesn't want to tell him where he really went, where he's supposed to go, and he's supposed to kill Jews. That he's not going to do. And that also explains in the next pasuk why he raided them in such a manner in which to leave no survivors.
Oh, right. But he could tell on him.
Right. No comebacks.
No witnesses.
Remember, you ever hear the short story called No Comebacks, written by Frederick Forsyth. V'ish v'isha lo yichaye David. David left no survivors. Lehavi gat lemor, in order that they should come back, not be able to come back to God, and saying, Ko asa David v'chol mishpato kol hayamim asher yashav bisdei haplishtim. Lo yechiye David levi gat lemor pen yagidu aleinu lemor. Ko asa David v'chol mishpato kol hayamim asher yashav bisdei haplishtim. So all of the years that he lived in, all of the year and 4 months that he lived amongst the plishtim, he would raid the Amalekites, he would raid the Canaanites, he would raid the locals down in the Negev, leaving the Yishuvim of Yehuda unharmed, but also in a certain sense protected, because those tribes in the south, the Amalekites, etc., they are the threat to the Yishuvim in Yehuda. So by shifting the focus of the attacks from Amalek to him, where has he shifted? What has he done for the Yishuvim and Yehuda?
He's helped them.
He has protected them, even if it's not directly, even if it's indirectly. He's kind of given the Amalekites a different target.
It's like two for one.
Right. So nobody noticed.
So it's a short period of time, but he's able to do that.
For a conversation with Hashem at this point, you know, is there any?
No, not really. David is not a Navi. He's got Navim with him, but he's not. And when you look at Paraglamid is now in the aftermath of all of this. You have to kind of skip around because we're looking at one piece of the story, in between there's other pieces which relate to Shaul and the Eshet Ov and the war in Gilboa. It's a different piece of it. When you come back to Perek Lamed, in the meantime, while David had gone up north to fight against with Achish against Shaul in the famous battle of Har Gilboa, back in Perek Lamed, Vayhi Bevod David Vanashav Tziklag, comes back home to Tziklag after being absent for 3 days. In the meantime, the people of Amalek had come and attacked the city of Tziklag and taken all the women and children captive. again, it's a ploy that works for David up until the point where David and his people are forced northward into a battle and leave Ziklag unprotected. And then Amalek says, okay, now's our chance. And they pounce. Amalek are slave traders. They will do anything to capture women and children, sell them as slaves. And so the dilemma, the world in which David is operating, is this world with his group of 400 people. They are an army. And they are protecting the local yeshuvim, fighting against the enemies of Israel, which are the local marauding troops of the south and the of Amalek and Gizri and whoever else is down there, and Midian and whoever else is down there. And it's fascinating because who should be protecting Israel from all of those enemies? Shaul. Shaul, right? Shaul is too busy up in the north to care about Shevet Yehuda. And he's too busy fighting the Plishtim on the other fronts, up in the northern part of the country. The southern border of Yehuda is totally exposed to all of the nomadic tribes of the Negev. And Shaul has certainly not wasted his resources protecting the southern flank when he's got his whole army up in the north fighting in the northern flank. And so the southern flank is left totally unprotected. And that's the role into which David steps.
What is the content of the things that he gathered and brought back?
The spoils?
Yeah, the spoils. That's the word.
What it says is cattle, tzon, bakar, money, clothing.
Would it be apparent that it would come from one group of people or rather than another?
At some point or another, we have to assume what the Navi tells us, which is that this ruse worked for a period of time. Right? Clearly it worked. Whatever the context is, however the questions we can challenge it with, but clearly it worked. So the reality is that they bought it. So that...
That he wasn't gathering women and children, was he?
No. No, he was not gathering women and children.
No survivors.
Now, so coming back to the question of his relationship with Naval HaKarmeli, now let's come back to, we're going to stay in Perek Lamed for a second, so sort of keep your hand there for a minute. And just jump back to Perek Chaf Hei. One of the questions that the Mefarshim struggle with, and we're going to see various approaches to this question, is did Naval know about the arrangement with David in advance? And David comes to Naval and asks for payment for protecting his shepherds and their flock, and we can see from the life of David, if you will, that that was not unexpected. Is Naval aware of the arrangement? And if he, whether he is or he isn't, is there an expectation of payment to David for this kind of work? So, from the context of the conversation between the Na'ar and Avigail, what emerges?
That there was an expectation.
That there seems to have been some knowledge, awareness, certainly, that all the days we went with them in the fields, right? Mm-hmm. That they sort of had the sense that this was an arranged relationship. And if that was an arranged relationship, then there should certainly have been some sort of compensation. In addition to the fact that this was not a small operation, this was not just 400 men, and we're going to expand that momentarily, but this was not a small operation, and this was a known type of relationship. You see it by you see it in Perek Lamed, right? When David goes and he counterattacks against Amalek and he smites Amalek, so look what happens in that context. Go back to Perek Lamed for a second. And starting with pasuk whole story there we'll read it another time, but he captures an Amalekite slave, meaning somebody who had ran away from Amalek, and he asks him who he is, and he says he's a slave to Amalek, and they had been on a raiding party, and they captured Ziklag, and he shows them where they are. So David takes his people. In a moment where I am. Hang on a second, I'm just looking for a pasuk. So let's start from pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayakem David me'aneshef v'ad ha'erev l'mochoratam. And David finally catches up to Amalek. He goes to battle with them for a day and a half. V'lo nimlat mehem ish. There are no survivors. 400 youngsters who managed to get away on camels, and David doesn't care about them, and he lets them go. David manages to recapture all of the people that they had taken from Ziklag. Right, nobody was missing. Everyone was accounted for, because Amalek didn't kill anybody. They didn't want to kill anybody, because they're slave traders. So anybody you kill, you lose as a potential source. V'kach David et kol atzon ve'abakar na'agu lifnei ha'mikneh ahu v'yamu zeh shlal David. They brought all of the cattle and all of the possessions, and they brought it back as spoils of war. So where are these spoils from?
Ziklag.
They are from Amalek. In other words, Amalek had raided not just Ziklag, they had raided a whole bunch of areas. Mm-hmm. If you go, I skipped that piece, but in Pasuk Yudalit, he lists all the places where they had raided. Nachnu pashatnu negav akreti, v'al asher liyuda, v'al negav kalev, v'etziklag. And we raided all of the various pieces. Your army was gone. So your army was gone, and we took advantage of the moment and raided everything. The whole southern region of Shevet Yehuda. So David goes and he captures all of this, Shlal David. I skipped that verse earlier also, but there was 600 people in his camp. He left 200 behind because they got to a certain point in which they couldn't cross the river. 200 of the older people were left behind, and the 400 crossed. Vayoshivum banachal habesor, got back to this river where they had left the 200 part of the camp. He gathers people and this is big greeting. So then he has a moment where the warriors say they want a larger portion of the spoils than those who got left behind because they did the fighting, and David says absolutely not. And Vayomer David, Pasuk Chav Gimel, Vayomer David, Lo Ta'asuchen Echai, my brethren, you shall not act this way. God has protected us. God has given this troop into our hands. Spoils are to be divided equally between those who went to war and those who had the desk jobs. Everybody gets paid equally. Okay? And for Ehimio Yom Ahuvamala Vaismel Lechokolu Mishpat Lisrael Ad Yom Hazeh, that became the new law in the world of David HaMelech. Wars, warriors are paid not because they do the more dangerous jobs, but because they're part of an army and everybody gets paid equally. Okay. Now look what happens next. Vayavod David El Tziklag Vayishalach Me'ashalal. So David comes to Tziklag. And now he begins to distribute the spoils of war. To whom? Liziknei Yehuda l're'eyu le'mor. To all of the elders of Shevet Yehuda. Hinei lachem bracha mishlal hevei Hashem. Here is the spoils of the enemies of God. La'asher bevet el, v'asher beramot negev, v'asher b'yatir, v'asher b'aroeh, v'asher b'sifmot, v'asher b'eshtemah, v'asher b'rachal, v'asher b'arei ha'yirach me'eli, v'asher b'arei ha'kini, v'asher b'chorma, v'asher b'chor ashan, v'asher b'atach, v'asher b'chevron, l'chol ha'mekomot, asher yitalech, sham David, hu v'anashav. All of the lists, the names of all of the cities of Shevet Yehudah where David and his people operated. He sent them all a portion of the spoils of war. Right. So clearly, this is a behavior and an arrangement that David and his people are known for. This is not a surprise. For Naval to claim, I don't know David, I don't know his people, I don't know who this is, I never made an arrangement with them, I never hired them, is an absurdity.
Yeah. He doesn't establish that.
Because this is how he's operating in Shevet Yehudah. This isn't born yesterday.
He's covered the whole
right. Thing. He is the protector of Shevet Yehudah. No surprise that after Shaul dies, Shevet Yehudah comes and says to David, you be our king, and the rest of the tribes of north, they're going to be loyal to Shaul's son. No surprise, because Shevet Yehudah has been protected by David for years, neglected by Shaul, and protected by David. This is David's group. This is his 400 people. They are an army. They are an army for hire. Clearly they're for hire. They have no other way of parnasa. They have no land, they have no flock, so they will protect the Yishuvim from the marauding Amalekites. And when they go to Achish, they're also out for hire. Achish hires them to attack Israel, to attack Judah. So he goes and attacks Amalek in order to pay Achish without having to
hurt
Judah. This is the world of David. I mean, sort of encapsulated in one 40-minute description, we've now reviewed five chapters, the end of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, right? This is the world of David. This is his army. This is what his army is doing. This is how they're operating. And so for Naval to come along and say, with a chutzpah, Mi David, Umi Ben Yishai, Rabu Ha'avadim HaMitparzim Mipnei Adonaihem, right, that David and his people are nothing more than a bunch of renegade slaves rebelling against their masters, it's not just chutzpah.
Seems stupid.
Right? It's audacious in its animosity and its rebellion, and it almost sounds treasonous.
Well, based on what you said last week with the names, with family, you know, relation.
So we'll come back to that piece too, right? What are you suggesting that he had a reason to do so?
Yeah.
But he also sounds stupid because here's a guy who killed Goliath. Does he think he's stronger than Goliath?
Right. But on the other hand, maybe he thinks he is. Maybe he thinks he's, you know, David is out on the run and a fugitive and hiding, and you know, he doesn't yet have a home base, and maybe he thinks he's weakened. Whatever.
Things happen in families and they last forever. You know, like people hold grudges and think and remember things, and like you lose connection with that family and whatever.
And
like,
you lose perspective too. You lose perspective too. We're going to come back to Naval. We're going to come back to Naval. But I think it's important to realize the extent to which David's reaction is harsh. Right. So he comes to war. He says he takes his 400 men. He says, okay, we're going to leave nobody alive. Right. The extent to which that is David's reaction. David lives by the sword. David does live by the sword. David at this point in time fits all the stereotypes of a warrior who lives by the sword. You don't cross him. Especially when you have an arrangement with him and he's out there risking his life to protect you and all the other Yishuvei Yehuda, and you have the chutzpah to challenge him, be careful. Because David knows how to use the sword.
If Naval was so wealthy, is it possible that he had his own protection and he wasn't relying on them?
No, because we see that he was relying on David.
That's what the guy says to us.
Right? Right. Take one of those, pass it down. Right? He was relying on David.
It's unbelievable. All this is happening, and Shaul's nowhere to be.
Shaul is nowhere to be seen.
Shaul
is
in the north.
He's not the whole thing.
Now, there's a flip side to that. You could argue that Shaul is, if you are living in a kingdom,
you might know what's going on.
No, whether he knows or not, it's not the issue. If you are living in a kingdom, and the kingdom has an army. And you set yourself up as a head of a band of mercenaries with your own army out for hire. So to establish an army under your leadership that is not under the control and command of the commander-in-chief of the standing army, there's a name for that. There's a word for it, building your own army not under the control of the army of the country in which you live. It's called treason. It's called treason. So as much as we could say, well, that Shaul is nowhere to be found, and is ignoring Shevet Yehudah, etc., there is at this point enough, clearly, I mean, he's accused inappropriately of treason. He's accused, Shaul tries to kill him for nothing. But at this point, he has really committed treason. Now, justifiably. Justifiably, the Navi told him to, and he had to, and he was mandated, etc. But from Shaul's perspective, and from the perspective of the rest of Malchut Yisrael, David really has committed treason. He's established his own army, and that's not done. So that's problematic.
I understand what you're saying about Naval. You know, should definitely must have had an understanding and knew that he was being protected. But he seems like such a low life type of person.
He is. he is.
Even if he didn't have an understanding, and just to know that he was being protected, he should have some hakaras or tov anyhow.
Okay.
At least to think.
Yeah, Naval is not known for hakaras hatov. That's true. That is true. Naval is exactly that. He is not known for hakaras hatov. Fair enough. In the 17 minutes remaining, what I wanted to kind of throw out there for consideration is the parallel to this story. The parallel to this story is remarkable. And I talked about it Shabbos afternoon in a different context. I don't know if you were there in the Shabbos afternoon this year, but there's a remarkable parallel to the story of David and his 400 men who go around protecting and fighting for those who can't protect themselves. And ironically, what is the parallel story to David and his army that are protecting those who can't protect themselves? Right? Ironically, what's the piece that's missing? When's the last time we had? Well, let's start from this perspective. When we first meet David, very first time we meet David and Melech.
He's a
Roi Basadeh. That is true.
What
else is he? When we are first introduced to David, the language that Navi uses is very specific and very frightening. And I've given you a brief source page, so I'll work down the source page for now because it'll be a little bit easier. Take a look at source 8. I'm going to do this out of order. Long since abandoned the order of my pages, so that's all right. Veishlach v'vi'eu, Shmuel comes to anoint whoever it is that God is telling him to anoint in the house of Yishai, one son after another. If you remember, they come and they look at them over. They bring the youngest. He says, "Do you have any more sons?" Mm-hmm. And God says, and Yishai says, "Oh, yeah. I got one more." The youngest, right. He's out back. Yeah, he's with the flock. Right. Okay, who is he? They bring him in. I want to see him. I want to meet him. Okay. V'yevieu, they bring him. V'hu admoni im yefei enayim. And he is admoni im yefei enayim. What is admoni im yefei enayim?
Gingy,
mm-hmm. Right? Admoni, red complexion or red hair, with beautiful eyes. Admoni miyefe enayim. V'tovru'i, very handsome. V'yomer Hashem kum shecheu ki zehu. God says to Shmuel, go, this is the one. So we pointed this out at the time, but we didn't talk about the significance of this parallel. But the word admoni is really extraordinary, because it appears twice in all of Tanakh. Correct.
Yeah.
V'hu admoni, so the Baal HaTurim points out, shnayim b'masoret, meaning there's only two references to the word admoni in all of Tanakh. The second is here, Vu Admoni, and the first is source 7, Vu Yetze Harishon Admoni Kula Kader Tse'ah Vayikru Shmo Esav. So the Medrash picks up on this and suggests that that's exactly why Shmuel hesitated. He looked like Esav. Looked like Esav. What are you, that's going to be the next king of Israel? So take a look. I'm going to skip around the sources. Take a look at source 13. Breshid Rabbah. Admoni, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, Ki'ilu Shofech Damim. Red complexion, that's like a murderer. Spill blood. Now, again, why did Chazal jump to the connection between Admoni and Shofech Damim? Where does that come to? You're going to suggest that anybody who's got red hair is a murderer? That would be quite an audacious statement for Chazal to make, right? And the answer is very simple. Because there's only one other person in Tanakh who's a red, who's described as Admoni, and that's Esav. Mm-hmm. And Esav's redness is linked to his profession. What's his profession?
Hunter.
He's a hunter. So what's wrong with being a hunter?
Because of the timing.
What's wrong with being a hunter?
Which you told us. Which I
well, hang on a second. Right, if you were there, like, hold, because we're going to be jumping ahead of the game.
You're not killing humanely?
Okay, you can hunt animals humanely. You can hunt animals inhumanely.
Oh, but I thought if you're, like, shooting with arrows and stuff, you're not doing shlita.
So that makes you a murderer?
Oh.
Why?
That makes you a mortar?
Enjoy killing?
I mean, it's a harsh. I mean, to accuse. I don't know. Something about Esav to accuse because he's a hunter that suddenly he's a murderer. It's a big jump. Go from being a hunter to being a murderer. So take a look. Hold that Bereshit Rabbah for a second, and look back at source 12. Well, source 10 and 12. Source 10 is the description of Esav. Vayigdalu anarim vayhi Esav ish yodea tzayid. It's a man who knows the field of hunting, ish sadeh, man of the field, v'yakov ish tam yoshev olim. Now look at source 12. The only other time we ever have the reference to a hunter in Tanakh, it's not a common profession. There's only one other person who's described as being a hunter. Hu aya gibor tzayid lifnei Hashem al ken yamar kenimrod gibor tzayid lifnei Hashem. The only other hunter we have in Tanakh is Nimrod. Nimrod. Who is Nimrod? Nimrod,
Vatehi.
No, Nimrod is the king of Bavel. Vatehi reshit mamlachto Bavel ve'erech v'yakad v'kane be'eret shin'ar. Nimrod is one who throws in the Medrash, who throws Avram into the furnace. Right. Nimrod is the king of Melech of Malchut Bavel. Nimrod is the king at the top of the tower of Bavel. Nimrod is a Gibor Tzayid. Now you tell me what Gibor Tzayid means when the next phrase is he was a Gibor Tzayid and he built an empire of Bavel and Erech and Akkad and Kanel and Eret Shinar. So you tell me what the word Gibor Tzayid means when it comes juxtaposed to building the largest empire in the ancient middle, in the ancient world. Right? If not a euphemism for
warrior.
A warrior. A Gibor Tzayid Kinimrod is a warrior. V'yitzchak ohev v'yigdalu anarim v'hi Esav ish yodea tzayid. Says the Gemara, says the Medrash in Preshit Rabbah, back to source 13, that David was Admoni like Esav. Shmuel took one look at him and he saw in him Esav, which makes him Shofech Damim, makes him a warrior. וכיוון שראה שמואל את דוד אדמוני, דכתיב וישלח והביא עבור אדמוני, נתיירא, ואמר, אף זה שופך דמים כעשיו. This one too is going to be like a murderer, like עשיו. אמר לו הקדוש ברוך הוא, יפה עיניים. He has a characteristic שעשיו doesn't have. He's got Leah's eyes. Remember Leah's eyes? עיני Leah רכות? יפה עיניים. What the עיניים represent is a much deeper conversation. Esav midat atzmo oreg. Esav kills on his own desire and passion. Ze midat Sanhedrin oreg. This one only goes to war when he has to, with the authorization of the Sanhedrin. This one is a melech. Okay, you can have the passion of a warrior, but the self control to be able to focus that into the context of a malchut instead of the ruffian that is Esav. Total. I get that. But the parallel between Esav and
David
is striking. But the parallel doesn't stop there. Okay? The parallel doesn't stop there. Because think about it. How many people are in David's group of warriors? 400. And then for some reason it expands. Right? It expands to 600 and expands to a whole city, but it's always identified as David and his 400 men, right?
That was his core.
Okay? Mm-hmm. That was his core. Okay. The last time we saw a band of 400 by number was Esav, beginning of Parshat Vayishlach. So now let's turn to Breshit and look at the beginning of Parshat Vayishlach. Parshat Vayishlach, Breshit Lamed Bet.
37.
Depends on what Pesach. He said, beginning of Parshat Vayishlach. Yaakov malachim lefanav al Esav achiv. Yaakov is coming back from the house of Laban where he ran to escape from memory. Where does the stereotype of Esav as a murderer come from?
Because
Esav threatens to kill
him. Right?
Correct. Esav threatens to kill him. That's enough. Right? The threat to kill your brother is enough to be stereotyped in the Chazal as a Shofech Damim. It's a serious accusation. And ultimately, Yaakov flees for his life. Yaakov comes back years later, and he doesn't know what to do with Esav. He's gone. He doesn't know what's happened with Esav. He doesn't know what to do with Esav. He doesn't know whether Esav's forgiven him or hasn't forgiven him. So he sends a delegation. Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lefanav al Esav achiv arta seir shdei Edom. Edom, south, Negev. Same region, by the way. Just think about it geographically. Right? It's the same region that David is operating in. Vayitzav otam lemor, ko tomun la'adoni Esav, ko amar avdecha Yaakov, im levangarti v'charadata. Parsha Vayishlach begins, he sends him a delegation to appease him, gives him tzon u'bakar and all kinds of animals to appease him. What do they come back with the message of? Pasuk Vav, Vayashuvu Hamalachim El Yaakov Lemor. Malachim come back and say, Banu El Achicha El Esav, we came to your brother Esav, V'gam Alech Likvatcha, he's coming to greet you, V'arbamiot Ishimo, with 400 people.
There it is.
Vayira Yaakov Me'od, to which Yaakov hears that Esav has 400 people, and he starts to shiver in his boots. Vayira Yaakov Me'od, he is tittering. Now, one of the questions the Mefarshim struggle with is why would Yaakov be so afraid simply because he heard that Esav has 400 people? Yaakov had just as many. He's got two big camps. He's struggled with angels. He's got a camp of angels. He's got an army of angels. He's got two major camps. He splits his camp into two. He's got avadim, v'shvachot, and gemal. He's got a fortune. Everything that he amassed from Esav. He's not coming back empty-handed. From Lavan. He's not coming back empty-handed. He hears about 400 people, and he starts to shiver. And that's the question of Mefarshim's struggle. Where do these 400 people come from and what do they represent? So if you look at the Mefarshim, and I found different approaches to this, but one in particular that I thought was just so powerful because it sends us into a new understanding of the world of David. Source 4. Chizkuni. Abam Yot Ish. You tell me whether you think this is pshat. Says the Chizkuni ve'abamiot ish imo lachlok lecha kavod. These 400 people are coming to give you kavod. He's coming with a delegation of 400 people to pull out the red carpet. Snapshot? What do you think? No. Does it sound like these four people are coming to greet greet Yaakov with open arms and embrace?
I mean, not right now.
And not from Yaakov's response either.
Right now.
All right. Says Radak, Gam olech lishvachatcha, Sheshema shataba, he heard that you're coming, Eino holech likvatcha l'shalom. He's not coming to meet you peacefully. Ela lemilchama. He's coming with war. Ki hu ba be'aba miodish. 400 people are not coming to embrace you. 400 people are coming to wage war. But he's still afraid. And the last source 6, which is really one of these obscure Rishonim that nobody ever quotes, but it's so, the comment here is so insightful. Abamiot ish tema lama haya mitirei Yaakov mehem balo adino ha'etzni harag chamesh miot bepam achat. I showed you the pasuk in the end of Shmuel Bet. Amongst David's warriors, he's got this guy by the name of Adino ha'etzni, who killed 800 people by himself. Shimshon killed thousands by himself. What's Yaakov afraid of with 400 people? And Yaakov is not a weakling. Yaakov could move the rock away with his pinky. Yaakov shenavakim amalach. Yaakov could fight with angels. Why was he afraid of 400 people? Does that make sense? Listen to what he says. Alachi pitrono. Hevimo abamiot ish, abamiot sarim. He came with 400 people, meaning 400 officers. She'ein sar shelo haya alafim ish tachtav. You don't have an officer that doesn't have thousands of troops under him. Vayasar v'shofet alehem. This was an army. 400 officers, 400 platoon leaders. When you count an army, you count divisions, you count platoons. You don't count soldiers. You count your forces by units. 400 units, 400 officers, 400 platoons, 400 divisions.
That's a whole different story.
Mm-hmm. And suddenly David's 400 men, that expands to 600, that expands to an entire city, right? The parallel between Yaakov, between David and Esav, is very real. I'll go one step further, and we're not going to have time to go through the text of it, so because I only have 2 minutes left. But I went through the Shabbos afternoon. Fascinating story in Parshat Toldot. When Yitzchok starts to dig wells, it's the parak right before the brachos. He starts to dig wells. What happens to him? He digs a well, and the plishtim come, mm-hmm. and they take it away from him. Mm-hmm. So Nebuch, poor Yitzchak, who, by the way, is the only farmer amongst the avot. Mm-hmm. You ever noticed that? Yitzchak zorea basadeh, he's planting in the fields, lasuach basadeh, he is me'asharim, Yitzchak's a farmer. All the avot were all shepherds. And by shepherds, they could be nomadic. Mm-hmm. Yitzchak's a farmer. And by being a farmer, you're tied to the land. Comes to the first place in Eretz Plishtim, under Melech Grar. Comes to the first place and he builds a well. And what happens? The Plishtim come and
take it away.
Yep. So he comes to the second place. Says, okay, you'll have to start all over again. Comes to the second place, digs a well. The Plishtim come and they throw him out again. So he goes further south. Every time the Plishtim throw him out from one place, he goes further south. So finally, he goes as far south as he can, in the area of Beersheba. If you take a look at Perichavav, I'm going to finish with this. Just one. Beersheba comes to a third, Pasuk of Bet, 26:22. He comes to a third well, far enough away from the Plishtim that they're not going to bother. It's not worth their while. So, okay. And there he dwells in Beersheba. God comes to him in Beersheba and he says, okay, you're going to have land. This is going to be your place. Pasuk Chavav. Avimelech halach elav migrar. Avimelech then comes to him from Grar, together with his army officer, his general, Fichol Sar Tzavo. And he says to him, "Vayomer alehem Yitzchak, madu abatem elav atem snetem oti? What are you coming to me for? You hated me." Like Yiftach, who said to the people of Israel when they came to him, "When you threw me out, what are you coming to me for?" Vayomru ra'ora inu ki ayah Hashem imach v'nomer tihina alav benotenu v'enenu v'necha v'nichata brit imach. We want to make a brit with you. You're very powerful. You're very wealthy. You're a power to contend with. You're an empire. We want to make a pact of equality with you, a brit. And this is the man who was just expelled from Eretz Plishtim, went from one city to another, run after, pursued by the Plishtim left, right, and center, and suddenly within the blink of an eye, out comes Fichol Sar Tzva'o, out comes Avimelech to make a brit with him, to embrace him, and he says to him, "You are an equal to us, you're a powerhouse amongst us." What do you mean you're a powerhouse? We just expelled you from our land. How can you be a powerhouse? You understand the problem? There's an optical illusion in this parak. The optical illusion is that we think this parak is all happening at one time. This parak starts with the story of Yitzchak going to Gerar and telling Yitzchak that Rivka is his sister, not his wife. Right. Tell me something. When you tell Avimelech that Rivka is your sister and not your wife, are you carrying two little boys in tow? No. Which means that clearly this parak begins, Yaakov and Esav are not born yet. Even though they're born in the previous chapter. They're not born yet. Wow. The end of this chapter, Esav is 40 years old. Esav is 40 years old. Right? This is an optical illusion. This is the world in which Esav grows up. And Esav's 400 men, or his army of 400 officers, grow up in a world of Yitzchak being pursued and run from place to place. Guess what changes? What changes is Esav. Mm-hmm. What changes is that Yitzchak grows into a massive powerhouse because suddenly he has an army at his disposal, and his army is led by Esav. Mm-hmm. When Yitzchak gives Esav the bracha to Esav, not to Yaakov, to Esav, and he says to him, "Al charbecha tichyeh, you will live by the sword," Yitzchak knows exactly what he's dealing with. Because Esav amassed an army, a massive army, that he used all those years to protect Yitzchak and to build Yitzchak into an empire. And he's surprised that Yitzchak had a soft spot for Esav. That's the world of Esav. That's the world Yaakov comes back to, and he hears Esav's coming to greet him with his group of 400 officers, and now he starts to fear for his life because he knows what he's doing. That's the world of David, who shares with Esav that characteristic of being the Admoni and the 400 men and the warrior, but who has that which Esav doesn't have, which is the eyes to the soul to be able to balance that as Admoni in Yefeinai. That's the world of David and Esav. All right, we're going to stop here. Wow. Yeah, Shabbat Hashem, we will.
Thank you.